Today's podcast is sponsored by Composer.Trade, the premier platform for investing in professionally created investment strategies that trade based on logic and data. Composer.Trade is putting the power of quant into the hands of regular investors. With Composer.Trade, you can invest in strategies that execute trades automatically, depending on market movements. You can even build your own strategy from scratch with their drag-and-drop portfolio editor. There's a reason why over $1 trillion is managed by quantitative hedge funds. Stop trading on impulse and start investing smarter today by going to composer.trade/value. That's composer.trade/value. See important disclaimers at composer.trade/disclaimer.
All right. Hello, and welcome to the Yet Another Value podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Walker. If you like this podcast, it would mean a lot if you could rate, subscribe, review it wherever you're listening. With me today, I'm happy to have Zach Buckley. Zach is the founder, portfolio manager, and maybe a couple of other titles at Buckley Capital Partners. Zach, how's it going?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for coming on. Really happy to have you on. Let me start this podcast the way I start every podcast. First, a disclaimer to remind everyone, nothing on this podcast is investing advice. Please consult a financial advisor, do your own diligence, all that type of stuff. And then the second way I start every podcast is with the pitch for you, my guest. We've been talking for several months. You're a super sharp analyst. I wish I had listened to you a little bit more seriously, because we were in a name and you called me up and you're like, I'm having a lot of worries. I think we're missing the story. I think the company's going to be a lot weaker than, and sure enough, stock's down about 50%, but we've been talking for months. You do great work on especially retail and consumer focused names. I'd say at least that's what we mainly talk about, but do fantastic work. I really enjoy talking to you. I'm really happy to have you on the podcast today. I think we're going to talk about a stock in depth today, but I don't know if you wanted to go a little bit deeper into your background and kind of your unique approach to everything.
Yeah, definitely. I started getting interested in investing when I was 16. My dad was a doctor. My mom was a psychologist. And my dad, unfortunately, very smart guy, but was a horrible investor. So he was investing in stocks in the late 90s, sold out in the early 2000s, started investing in real estate around 2002, through 2007. So just couldn't really time a worse investment approach than what my dad had. And so my parents were always stressed about money, and I wanted to be a doctor at the time, but I didn't want to stress about money the way that they did. And so I started getting interested in investing. So I was a voracious reader, always have been, certainly was in high school. I was reading 30 to 40 books a year. And I just came across Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett, and was just totally obsessed with value stuff, really, since I was 17 or 18. My dad gave me $100,000 to manage in November of 2007. So I was 19 at the time.
That was my class. You want to talk about times where it would have been pretty easy to blow $100,000.
Yep. So it was a great time to learn. I was kind of down with the market in 2008. Had a really good year in 2009, which was up triple digits in 2009. And I was trying to figure out a way to get into the hedge fund industry. I went to University of Miami. And so it wasn't obviously a feeder school for the hedge fund industry, but I wanted to manage a hedge fund ultimately. And so I actually taught myself to play poker. So I was playing poker professionally to pay bills. And then that allowed me to not immediately have to get a job. And basically I filed the formation documents for the fund my second semester senior year, and launched with $500,000, basically 6 months after I graduated in January of 2011. So I had a really good year in 2011 and was able to get to about $25 million in assets at the beginning of 2012. And then, we've grown it from $25 million in 2012 to just under $100 million today. So
that's awesome, yeah. Man. That's really cool. I didn't know you had that poker background. You and Evan Tindell, y'all came out at the same time, poker background. It's funny how many investors have that poker overlap.
Yeah, no, there's a ton of overlap, which I'm sure we could spend an entire episode just talking about, but definitely a lot about expected value and how to think about probabilistic range of outcomes and, bet sizing. And so there's a lot of parallels between the two.
There is a monthly finance poker gathering, which I just got an invite to the first time. I know you're in Chicago, but next time you're through New York, maybe we'll see if you can come through and probably take all of our money.
I'm actually Miami based, but
I thought you were in Chicago for some reason.
No, my phone number, because I grew up in Chicago, so my phone number is a 630. I play in that New York finance poker game, I believe. So
okay, we'll talk about that offline. But Great. That's great background. So I guess next thing to turn to is just the company we're going to talk about today. The company is Xponential Fitness. The ticker is XPOF. And I'll pause there and just ask, you know, what's Xponential Fitness and why is it so interesting?
Yeah. So Xponential Fitness is a boutique provider of fitness. So they have 10 different brands in total. And so, you know, people are essentially, you know, it's been a huge trend recently where there's been huge growth across their different locations. So they have 2,300 plus locations at this point. And their primary brands are Club Pilates, which has 750 studios, Pure Barre, which has about 620. And then their third largest is Cycle Barre, which is just over 250. So, you know, out of those three, you have about, you know, 1,600 of the, you know, 2,300 plus total. And so, you know, those three are the majority of the business, but you still have 10 brands in total. You know, they've been growing extremely well. They IPO'd last year, so July of 2021. And we just think that it's a perfect business to own in this environment because it's inflation resistant because, you know, they're a franchisor. And so they're basically getting, you know, the top line revenue of all their franchisees payments. So it's very inflation resistant. It's recession resistant because their customer is an affluent enough customer base where, you know, they're not really being impacted significantly. You know, if they're paying $130 a month, you know, for their fitness and they're making an average of $130,000 a year, you know, they're not going to change their fitness or, you know, they're not going to decide to stop going to the gym just because, you know, things have gotten a little bit tougher in a recession. They can handle a recession and fitness is a priority for their customer base. And so, we think they're really perfectly positioned and we don't think it's been fully recognized yet by the investment community. So I think people are worried about the typical things that people worry about when businesses first IPO. You know, Planet Fitness had a lot of the same concerns. And, you know, we actually think that Xponential Fitness and Planet Fitness will kind of have a similar path where Planet Fitness was trading at a pretty low multiple in the first 15 months after it IPO'd. And then in months 16 through 38, the multiple, you know, more than doubled and the stock was up over 200% in that time frame.
And look, that's a really interesting comp because as you said, Planet Fitness, there were lots of doubts about it. It's fitness. There were lots of fad claims. I'm looking at it right now. Obviously, it's got a much bigger EBITDA number, but, you know, it used to trade for pretty small and now it's trading for well over 20 times EBITDA, I would say, which would be a nice path for Xponential, same franchise model, at all that sort of stuff. So lots of stuff I want to pull on there, but I guess I'll just start with one thing. You know, I think a lot of people, when you say, oh, I'm investing, you know, I was very skeptical until I started reading it last night. And, you know, these are real brands. They've got real history. The management seems real. But even some analysts I saw at conferences would say, hey, if we invest in Xponential Fitness, you know, history is kind of against us. There are not a history of a lot of successful publicly traded fitness companies. Like, kind of the only one that I can think of is Planet Fitness, actually. You know, like at this point, Peloton's a disaster. But even before that, there were histories of New York sports clubs, all these other things. They'd come out, they'd be public, and then, you know, after a year or two, churn would start to work against them, all the stuff, and the stock would just kind of crash and eventually bankruptcy or restructuring, all that sort of stuff. So why do you think, like, with Xponential Fitness, history is different this time?
Yeah, I think there are a few things. So, you know, definitely a fair point. You know, I would point out F45 is one of their main competitors or perceived competitors. And, you know, F45 came public almost the exact same time that they did and, you know, it was done horribly. So
I tweeted out yesterday, I was looking at F45 to prep for this podcast, and I think they had the worst miss I've ever seen a company do where, you know, at the start of this year, they were saying, I think we're going to grow store base by 1500. And I'm trying to find the exact number that they said, but now at the start of this year, they said they were going to do 1500, maybe bigger before that. And now it's like under 400. I mean, it's unbelievable how bad the miss was.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess this is probably a good time for me to talk about, you know, we use alternative data sources in a lot of the analysis that we do. You know, with Xponential Fitness, we're definitely following the data on a week-to-week basis to make sure that we understand what the trends are and how the business is doing. you know, we have no expectation. And I think there are good reasons to believe why they should grow well over a long period of time and why they won't be like F45 is and like other failed fitness brands are. But, you know, we are very careful and basically following the short-term results to make sure that our long-term thesis ends up playing out. So the reason why I think the long-term thesis will play out. So the first thing is there's a diversified portfolio of very successful brands. So, you know, Club Pilates is 9 times larger than its nearest competitor. Pure Bar is 8 times larger. You know, Cycle Bar is 3 times larger. So they're buying the dominant players in their various verticals. You know, BFT was their most recent acquisition. Now that's one of the most dominant fitness, basically boutique fitness concepts in Australia and Southeast Asia. So they're buying the best concepts in various areas, and then they're managing them and growing them extremely well. But it's also a diversified portfolio of brands. I'm sure not every concept is going to be perfect, but they have 10 concepts. And so, you know, their main concepts are doing extremely well. So I think that's the first thing. I think just looking at their track records. So Club Pilates had, you know, 12 studios 7 years ago and has 750 studios today. It had AUV of 250,000 in 2015 and has AUV of 750,000 today. So they have done an exceptional job of managing these brands. You know, I think management's really important. Tony Geisler has been doing this since 2001. You know, he's been very successful in the industry. He's probably the only person that's been in the industry for over 20 years. So I think we're betting on the right person, the right management team, and the right brands within boutique fitness. I think the other thing is just the industry in general. You know, it's been growing at a 6% CAGR since 1999. So the boutique fitness industry itself is growing very rapidly and is projected to grow at a 6% CAGR for the next 4 or 5 years. So the industry itself, I think, is very strong, and I think they're very strong within it.
That's perfect. I think you did a nice job addressing it, but I just want to go back one thing to the sustainability of the brands, because I did some work on it. And I am a little concerned there. You mentioned Club Pilates. I mean, that's been tremendous, right? I believe it was 12 units 5 years ago, and that's when they acquired it, right? And now we're 5 years later, it's 750 units. AUV has absolutely exploded, all that sort of stuff. But I did just, maybe it's because Club Pilates, but I remembered my mom 10 or 15 years ago loved to go to this brand Curves, right? And Curves had similar exponential growth. You know, it went from under 100 units to, at its peak in 2009, I think it was approaching, it was getting up to 8,000 or 9,000 units. And then 7 years later, the thing is approaching 1,000 units, right? It was just exponential up and exponential down. And I was just wondering, like, is that the history of these types of new things? Like, I think CrossFit has had some legs, cycling. I don't know if that's a new form of exercise, but you know, the brands have come and gone. And I just worry, hey, great, you did Club Pilates, but it's not like there aren't other Pilates competitors out there. So why do you think like these brands in particular are kind of sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really just based off the history and track record that they've had so far. You know, and of course, there's no guarantee that they couldn't have trouble in the future. But I think all investing we have to look at is what's happened historically, and is that reasonable that it should persist? You know, Club Pilates has resonated extremely well with consumers. You know, that is, you know, by far the best brand that they have, and probably the strongest that they have. It's obviously experienced exceptional growth in the past, you know, 7 years. So is it possible that it flares out over some period of time? I think it's very unlikely. But that is why we follow the data so closely, because we're always seeing if we could be making a mistake. We're always second guessing and trying to be as critical of our positions as possible. But I would say, you know, there are flare ups, there are blow ups in every business. And, you know, I think you mentioned a few in the fitness space, but there's nothing that makes me think that their brands should experience that.
Let's quickly talk valuation, and then I think there are actually more things, more interesting things to the story, but valuation can always serve as a baseline, right? Like, as I look at it, they've got a little bit of a complex cap structure, which we can talk about if we want to, but I've got them kind of at like a $1.3 billion enterprise value. They're guiding, midpoint of guidance is about $70 million of EBITDA this year. So you're talking about 19 times EV to EBITDA. Look, this, again, this is a franchise model, right? So they don't own, sure, they don't own the units. I mean, this is very cash rich. EBITDA is going to track really well into cash flow and all that type of stuff. So when I say 19 times EBITDA, like that, seems reasonable for a franchisor. I think like QSR and a lot of other people who are much more mature, and that'll come into play in a second, probably trade a slightly cheaper multiple, but nothing crazy. As we said, Planet probably trades around 20. So when I say those multiples, is there anything you would push back there, or is that kind of good for just an overview of the two-day 2022 valuation?
Nope, you got it right. And I would point out the sell side gets it wrong, and other places get it wrong. So nice job.
What do they get wrong about it?
A lot of times they'll leave out the preferred, or they'll get, they'll get the share count wrong. So a lot of the sell side has the enterprise value closer to $1 billion. And that's, you know, that's not correct.
Well, I'm glad I could get that right. It is complicated though, right? Like you mentioned,
very complicated.
They've got class A, class B. There are some Rumble payout units you have to decide if you want to put in there or not. But yeah, so we've got the baseline established. I think the thing you're tracking, obviously 18 times, 19 times for a franchisor, not cheap, not expensive. I think the thing you're really talking about here is the growth, right? So why don't we talk about the growth? Like they talk about how they've got a lot of growth in the backlog. A lot of this growth is like absolutely baked in. So I'll just turn it over to you. What's the growth? And, you know, why do you think this is not 18 times, but, you know, 10 times 2 years out or something?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think, you know, next year they'll probably do in the ballpark of $100 million of adjusted EBITDA. So I think it's probably 13 times on next year's numbers, you know, and that could and probably should flow into over $1 a share in free cash flow. So we think it's trading at, you know, somewhere in the ballpark of 19 times next year's free cash flow, which for a, you know, recurring revenue franchise business that is, you know, inflation and recession resistant, we think it's really attractive. You know, Planet, its closest peer, trades at 33 times. And to your point, sort of the other dominant, you know, franchise businesses typically trade at 25 to 30 times. So that's kind of our near-term view. You know, longer term, you know, looking out 5 years, we think they'll earn between $2.50 and $3 a share in EPS or free cash flow per share. And, you know, we think that should trade at, I mean, the peers today trade at, you know, 25 to 30 times earnings. Planet Fitness trades at 33 times earnings. So you can kind of pick what you think is a fair multiple. You know, I think everyone has differing views on valuation, but you can easily see how this could be a $75 to $100 stock in 5 years.
Yep. And, yeah. I mean, the very conservative math, 20 times 250, right? Which is low end of what you said. 20 times, again, for a franchise, it should be very inflation resistant. You just take that franchise fee up and actually your margins go up because you're leveraging your G&A a little bit more. I don't think anybody would argue with 20 times if you've got that stability. That's 50. That's more than a double from a $19 stock price today. Okay. So that's great. Let's talk about management here, right? So you mentioned, and the CEO likes to tell everyone, hey, I'm the only person in the boutique industry, the boutique fitness industry, who's been here for over 20 years. We'll probably talk recession a bit, but every time people talk recession, he says exactly what you said, right? Like, hey, I had LA Boxing in 2008 and people were worried about this. And, you know, people will go, I think one of his quotes was people will go on welfare before they'll give up their boutique fitness, which anyway, I'm rambling a little bit, but let's talk about the management team because it's important for any franchise story. Management is the one shaping the brands, management is the ones driving it. There's probably going to be more acquisitions to come. So I'll kind of pause there.
Yeah. Yeah. In general, we love to find obsessed and hungry owner operators. And we think Tony fits that really well. You know, he's been in the business forever. I think he knows it as good or better than anyone. And I think he's done a phenomenal job in assembling, you know, a portfolio of really high quality brands and monetizing that brand portfolio. So I think, you know, they've done a lot of smart things that I think were creative. You know, the B2B partnerships that they're exploring are really interesting. So, you know, they just signed with Princess Cruises, which is basically, you know, 23,000 staterooms that will get, you know, over 1 million views a year now. So, you know, that's 1 million incremental people in their customer funnel that they're essentially getting paid for. You know, they partner with Lululemon, with Mirror. So they have four of their brands now that are going to be on Mirror. You know, they partner with LA Fitness. They have over 500 studios that are going to open within LA Fitness. So they're doing all of these creative and intelligent things that I think, you know, I'm hoping and sort of expecting that they'll be able to actually beat the guidance that they've laid out. And I think they're very thoughtful about understanding that, you know, it's always better to be in a position where you can beat and raise over time. So I think even though the growth that has been set out is significant over the next 3 or 4 years, I actually think they intend to beat and raise across that guidance over time, and that it's pretty conservative relative to their expectations. And the B2B partnerships is part of it. So, but going back to the management team themselves, I think, you know, I wouldn't want anyone else running this company besides Tony. I think he has a great team around him. I think, you know, Sarah, the president, and John, the CFO, are also really strong. So we've spent time with all of them, you know, been to the offices in Irvine. I've been really impressed with the team and think they're kind of the right group to take this to the size that they wanted to. And he's super ambitious, like his aspirations, you know, he talks about $100 stock price. Like that's his expectation. That's what he wants to happen. You know, he wants this to be a much larger business than it is today. And I expect it will be.
And I think he owns a ton of stock here too, if I remember correctly from reading the proxy. I think some of it's Class B and stuff, but he's certainly incentivized to get up there.
It's confusing, but he owns about 20% and the chairman owns about 20%.
Yeah.
And the other insiders own about 5. So they're about 45% of the ownership of the company.
So you mentioned the partnerships, and I guess let's quickly talk the partnerships. I was going to save it for later, but I did think they were interesting. So they've got the partnership with Princess, you mentioned. They're partnering on Mirror. And I thought they were interesting because, as you said, that's a lot of, it seems like a free, they're not just free, they're getting paid for these things, a way to drive traffic. But then I could see the pushback, like, hey, you know, people going on Princess Cruises isn't exactly the most targeted traffic. Maybe there's a little bit of management headache. Like I haven't really seen, there's another publicly traded company that does Medi Spas on cruises. Like it's kind of tough to make good economics on cruise partnerships. So I could see it going both ways, but you think the partnerships, the Mirror, all this, you think they are smart. They are going to add value over time.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, they're getting paid for them. So at worst, they get extra money in their pocket. At best, they get, you know, extra customers in their acquisition funnel. You know, I think Celsius and C4 is another partnership where, you know, they're paying people to have access. I mean, what would you pay to advertise in 2,300 studios, right? Like that's a huge customer base that you get to have access to. And so they actually hired the former brand partner of the Chargers. So they basically have, you know, because having access to a football team is a huge value as well. And so, you know, they wanted to bring someone in that understood how to work with partners and basically grow that business. So I think they're just getting started there. And I think they really expect to significantly ramp the B2B partnerships that they have. And what they've done so far, I think, is really impressive.
Let me ask something on structure here. So XPOF owns, I think it's up to 12 franchises, right? And you mentioned the big one. There's Rumble, which there's a couple classes. I always focus on that one because there's a couple of boxes right by my house, and I've been to a couple of classes. I have one friend who's obsessed with them. But, you know, 12 franchises under an umbrella does strike me as strange, right? Like I think about QSR, which owns Burger King, Popeyes, Firehouse Subs, Tim Hortons, right? So that's 4 brands. I think about Yum, that's Pizza Hut, KFC, and Taco Bell. Most franchises that I've seen like have kind of max out at 3 to 4 brands, and these guys are already up to 12 and they clearly want to go do more. So my first question there, we'll talk synergies between the brands and XPass in a second, but my first question there is just like 12 brands underneath one umbrella, that does seem like a lot. It seems like there'd be like kind of a lot of management distractions. Like, is that just too many brands? Are they actually going to be able to go buy more and kind of focus and grow all of these brands?
Yeah, they have, you know, management teams for each one of those brands, right? So they have a president and a CMO, you know, under them for each one of those brands. And so far, I haven't really seen it as being an issue. You know, I think the other thing that's important to consider is that, you know, the top three are the vast majority of the business. So it really is still focus primarily on those three brands, although I do expect them to expand to more brands over time. The other thing I would say is there's plenty of conglomerate structures that work really well, right? Berkshire Hathaway is an easy example of, you know, having a you know, very decentralized management structure where you have a portfolio of businesses that works really well over time. Obviously, private equity firms own, you know, more than 10 brands over time. So I think while I agree that it's somewhat unique in a public company structure, I think there's plenty of examples.
No, I hear you. Nobody's going to say Berkshire Hathaway hasn't worked out well for people, but it does strike me like Berkshire warrants just kind of capital allocating. And here, I do think you have a CEO whose skills are brand building and building companies and stuff. And that's a little bit more hands-on than the Berkshire model where you just have the CEO capital allocating.
Yeah, I think in some of the models he's not that hands-on. I think that's kind of the idea. I think he is really focusing on the high level stuff, which is like, you know, new brand partnerships, stuff like XPass and XPlus. But I don't think he's thinking about like the day-to-day operations of CycleBar, you know, or Rumble. I think that's really the job of the president of CycleBar, or the president of Rumble.
Makes total sense. Let's talk synergies, right? So you've got 12 brands underneath this umbrella. And I think the argument for having this many brands would be there's some types of synergies. And you can think of a couple right off the top of your head, right? Like increasingly, it's important for any boutique to have their own app, their own technology and stuff. And yes, you can license it. Like I go to a one-shop boutique. They've got the same app that basically Barry's does, right? So you can license this stuff and everything, but there's other synergies there too. So you can get lots of synergies on the G&A, all that type of stuff. But I think the real synergy would come from something like XPass, right? Which is this thing, which is their thing where you sign up, you can pay a certain amount per month, and then you can use those credits to go to all of their studios, right? So instead of just having a 10 pack to go to Rumble, you'd have a 10 pack and one day you could go to Rumble, one day you could go to Stretch Lab, one day you could go to their Pure class and everything. So you could see how there could be synergies by giving you access to all the brands. So I want to pause there and say, just synergies overall on the cost side, do you think that's one of the drivers for XPOF? And then B, XPass, which is pretty unique to me, do you think that's a value driver long term?
Yeah, definitely. No, I think, so XPass right now is about 15% of their new lead generation. So I think, you know, they're definitely driving a ton of new traffic and new leads from XPass. So there's clearly going to be synergies on the customer acquisition funnel. And obviously getting AUVs up is a huge part of the story over time. So, you know, their expectation is AUV should go from about 500,000, you know, roughly where they are now, to about 600,000 over the next few years. And I'm sure part of that is going to be XPass. So I think there are synergies on the revenue side with XPass, with certainly the B2B partnerships that they're doing. And then I think there's obviously synergies on the cost side, right? The back office and being able to have shared services. And we're going to see that the adjusted EBITDA margin is going to scale from, you know, roughly 30% to, you know, about 45% over the next few years. So you're going to see, you know, a very high margin business emerge over the next few years as this business grows.
How does the economics of XPass work, right? So I sign up for XPass, I think there's $250 a month would get me 15 classes. If I book one class at Rumble and one class at Stretch Labs through that, like how much is corporate taking versus how much is the franchisee taking? Because if I go buy a Rumble 10 pack, Rumble keeps all that money outside of whatever they say send upstairs in the kind of franchise royalty, right? But if I buy it through XPass, is there a difference? So do you have this thing where Rumble's trying to encourage people, hey, don't buy XPass, buy directly from us or something?
No, you don't. And they haven't disclosed exactly what the economics are between them and between the franchisees, but I'm sure you can assume that they're essentially figuring out a way to incentivize all the franchisees to sell the XPass. And I think at the end of the day, the franchisees are going to want, just more volume coming to their business. And I'm sure, you know, XPass is incentivizing that.
Okay. Yeah. I thought I saw somewhere that they were doing a 70-30 split, but I could have been mistaken. But yeah, it just strikes me as something, you know, I love going to gyms and I've seen these before. And it strikes me as something where you could have this really weird thing where like there's ClassPass in New York. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but you buy ClassPass, like ghost gyms, and basically says, hey, we'll send you flex capacity. And every gym you go to, they like ClassPass because it gets new members in there. But once you're there, obviously that's not a corporate offering. That's a third party. But once you're in there, they're like, hey, buy from us. Don't buy from ClassPass. Please, please, please. Like we don't want to give ClassPass all that margin and stuff.
Sure. No, and that makes sense that class, you know, there would be sort of a disincentive between, you know, just because ClassPass is third party versus this is all in one ecosystem.
Yep. Okay. Let's talk. I normally do this up front, but I was so excited, like reading into the story and stuff yesterday that I kind of just wanted to dive right into the story itself. But let me back up a bit. My first question is generally the market's a really competitive place. We started diving into it, but you've got to kind of have something differentiated in the market to generate risk-adjusted alpha going forward. So I guess my question to you would be like, what is the thing that you think you see with XPOF that the market's missing that will make this a risk-adjusted alpha generator going forward?
I just think that the market is not expecting the EBITDA multiple to expand over time. So I think it's a combination of things. I think the first thing is, everything that you said about, people are kind of doubting the model at this point. And so I think for a business that's going to grow as quickly as it is over the next 5 years, it's trading at a very low multiple, because you can look out 5 years and say, this business with a very high degree of probability, was going to do 250 plus in EPS. And so if you could buy, a highly recurring franchise revenue business at, 7 or 8 times earnings, that's an incredible purchase, because those businesses typically trade, like we said, at 25 to 30 times. So I think that's the first part. I think there's skepticism around the model, and that's just creating a lower multiple than where it should trade. I think that's honestly most of what it comes down to. I think there's just a very clear roadmap to this business being significantly larger over the next 5 years. It's very easy to model out. It's very consistent. And I think people just aren't trusting that. And I think generally what happens as a company becomes public longer, as it continues to beat and raise over time, people get more confidence in the model. And as people get more confidence, the multiple goes up.
Do you think, obviously they've done a lot of acquisitions. Club Pilates, we mentioned, is just an absolute home run. They just did one, I believe it's Australia focused, BFT. They acquired Rumble late last year. Do you think there's more acquisitions going forward, and that's kind of a driver of the story as well? Or do you think at 12, they're kind of focused on just growing the brands under their house?
Yeah, so they have 10 right now, and they definitely expect to grow that over time. So I would expect to see more acquisitions in the future.
Okay.
And I definitely think that will be a part of the growth over time.
I wonder where I saw 12 from. Yeah, you're right. It's 10. I'm looking at the chart. I've got 12 up there. That's bad me. Bad me. Let's talk opportunity cost, right? So somebody tweeted out and asked, hey, why buy XPOF at 20 times EBITDA when there's oil and gas stocks trading at 2 times EBITDA? So there is just the opportunity cost of the market as a whole, right? There's that. But I think the more relevant opportunity cost is, look, there are other franchise models out there, right? Like Planet Fitness would be the most direct one. That is a franchise model of gyms. Now, those are lower cost everyday gyms versus boutique. But, why XPOF versus Planet, which is kind of trading at a similar multiple on the nearer term numbers? Or if you want growth franchise stores, Joint, JYNT, is a very popular stock among value investors. That's franchise chiropractors. And I don't know if you've done work on Joint or anything, but I would just say, like, why XPOF over Planet, Joint, any of the other smaller cap franchisers?
Yeah, I mean, so we're just always modeling out what we think earnings are going to look like in 5 years and what we think the appropriate multiple for the business is, and then looking at the IRR. So, Planet is already trading at 33 times earnings.
Yep.
And has, probably high single digit, low double digit EPS growth. That to me is not that exciting of an IRR. Like, I think Planet's probably the IRR will probably be kind of what its EPS growth rate is, So if maybe a 10% sort of base case IRR for Planet, my base case, XPOF IRR over the next, 5 years is 30%+. So, I think to be able to buy a business that's highly predictable, extremely stable, again, inflation resistant, recession resistant with a 30% plus IRR, I think that's really attractive. I think the Joint is probably an interesting investment. I haven't spent time on it myself. But the CFO of XPOF, he was formerly CFO of the Joint. So the only time I looked at the Joint was after meeting him. So, but the Joint could be interesting. I just can't speak to it. But when I look at most other franchise concepts, they're trading at 15 to 20 times EBITDA or 25 to 30 times earnings, and they're growing earnings in the, low double digits for the most part. And so, this is trading at lower multiples and growing 3 times faster.
Yep. Let me ask you a strange question. So these guys are obviously growing really quickly. And I was kind of wondering, are they riding COVID tailwinds too hard, right? Like, not that they're intentionally doing it, but the COVID reopening has been such a tailwind for them. I've been wondering if their growth rate almost comes down as the world normalizes. And I mean it in this way, right? Like, I think they gave the stat 30% of boxes went under during COVID. They didn't have a single box closed, but that creates a heck of a lot of real estate for them to kind of purchase, add locations, all that type of stuff. a lot of excess equipment, a lot of particularly excess labor, right? Like the SoulCycle down the street closes, and they even gave this example. SoulCycle closes. We go into that location. We split it into two boxes. Guess what? There are 8 SoulCycle instructors who are out of work, who are probably fantastic, great trained, who we can go and add to one of the boxes. So no labor shortages facing them, no real estate shortages. It's almost like open space. And I've wondered, as the world normalizes more, as kind of all that excess real estate is absorbed, is there almost like a brick wall coming in front of their growth where all of a sudden they say, oh, it's a lot harder to find instructors. Oh, all of the boxes that were empty have kind of been filled. So it's much more of a turf war to grow going forward. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I guess let me address two things. You know, first is kind of what they've guided to in terms of long-term growth, just so you have a sense of that. And then I also kind of just want to talk about the individual studio economics, just so you can kind of understand.
Next like question. So that's perfect. Yep.
Yeah. Like how profitable they are, because they're, you know, the individual franchisees opening these up get a 40% cash on cash return. So, you know, labor could be a little bit tougher, or rent could go up a little bit. And, you know, maybe the cash on cash return goes from 40 to 37, but it's not going from, you know, 40 to 10 or something. It's going to stay very attractive. You know, in terms of their long-term guide, so they're saying 500 plus annual new studio openings. So on a 2,300 base, you know, they're talking about studio openings, you know, north of 20%. And so, you know, they're also talking about mid to high single digit same store sales growth. And if you look pre-COVID, that's what they were doing. They were doing, you know, most quarters between 5% and 9% same store sales growth. So if you sort of layer on the same store sales growth on top of the studio growth, you know, you're in the mid to high 20s already on a revenue basis. And then, like I said, adjusted EBITDA margins are going to expand from 30 to 45%, you know, over the next few years. So the adjusted EBITDA growth is going to be well in excess of that revenue growth, you know, say in the, you know, 35% plus range. And so, you know, those all seem like very reasonable goals to me, just given what they've done historically, right? Like, looking at their historical growth, looking at what they've done this year, you know, they're going to open 500 plus studios this year. You know, they have a pipeline already, basically double what their studio base is. So I think they have another 2,600 studios that have already been contractually signed. So those are already guaranteed to roll out, you know, so that's, I think, very predictable. And then you have the pre-COVID same store sales growth, which in my mind, there's no reason why, you know, I would think they wouldn't be able to achieve that. So when I put all that together, I just have a high degree of confidence in their ability to meet that. And I also think they've been kind of conservative. You know, they talk about their, you know, revenue growth rate as low to mid teens, sort of on a longer term basis. You know, and I think they're talking like 5 years from now, low to mid teens, because I think for the next 5 years, it's going to be, you know, 20% plus.
Just on the, I think a lot of the pushback on the idea that I've seen, you know, particularly from the sell side, I tend not to read a ton of sell side research, but you could kind of, the XBOF does a lot of conferences, so you could see what the sell side was really targeting. A lot of the pushback has been on the franchisee's economics. And I mean that in two ways. Number one, I think there's been a lot of pushback on the 40% cash on cash return number, which, you know, does make sense to me. You say, hey, we're opening a gym, we're paying a 6 to 8% royalty to the kind of corporate mothership, plus we're buying the equipment from them, all that sort of stuff. Like 40% cash on cash return sounds very high for a gym, you know, that can be easily copied and everything. So that's one aspect, pushback on the 40%. And then the second aspect, and I think this bleeds into the 40%, is a lot of people have said, oh, the franchisee base here is mainly made up of people who own 1 to 3 units, not the McDonald's where, you know, everybody owns 20 or 30 units or something. And the pushback on that has been along two lines. A, if the cash on cash returns are really 40% plus, why aren't people like going all out and getting up to 40 units in a market or something, right? Four Rumbles, 3 Cycles, whatever it is. And B, if everybody's at 1 to 3, like, do you have an unsophisticated investor base that might think it's 40% cash on cash, but that's because they're not factoring in, you know, the value of their time. They're kind of getting paid the classic, hey, I get paid $100,000 a year, but I work for owning a laundromat, but I work 100 hours a week or something. So I basically make minimum wage, like that type of thing. Or maybe they're not factoring in depreciation of the equipment, all of that. So I'll pause there. I threw a lot out there. What do you think about that? How people talk about the franchise base?
Yeah. So you know, the initial investment in the average store is about $350K. You know, the average annual revenue in year two is about $500,000. You know, labor per month is about $10,000, so call it $120,000 a year. You know, rent per month is in sort of the $10,000 range. You know, so and those are the two biggest expenses. So those combined are say about $250K per year, and so you have you know, about $250K, you know, after those to work with. And they're kind of saying that most of the franchisees are making between $125K and $150K a year. So there's probably an additional, you know, $100 to $125K of cost below that, you know, which is going to be technology. It's going to be, you know, electricity, you know, sort of all of the other expenses that we haven't described. You know, so I'm sure there's variability among the franchisees. I'm sure some franchisees do significantly better and some do significantly worse. Certainly the Club Pilates franchisees have done exceptionally well, right? AUVs expanded from 250 to 750, you know, and that's why they're raising the royalty rate. So if the franchisees were not doing well, you know, they wouldn't be able to raise the royalty rate and still have, you know, basically double the current base already sold, right? So they have more than 750 Club Pilates already sold. The other thing is they only accept about 2% of the franchisees who want to become franchisees, right? So if it really wasn't that attractive and if people really weren't doing well, I can't imagine that you'd have, you know, 50 people for every one person that they actually accept into the program. You know, a 2% acceptance rate for franchisees doesn't imply to me that it's a bad business to get into. It actually, it strikes me as like a pretty great opportunity.
It reminds me of Chick-fil-A a little bit, right? Where they've got the classic. I think they take less than 1 in 100 or something, but they've got all sorts of things. And obviously everybody loves to own a Chick-fil-A franchise because those things mint money despite being closed on Sundays. Let me turn to recession risk. We talked about recession a little bit, but just we'll talk about recession for the overall business. But just on the franchisee side, I was wondering, recessions, rising rates and stuff. Obviously, a franchisee needs most of them get equipment loans to buy the equipment to set up a box, you know, get the real estate, that type of stuff. It's operating leases, but you probably do need some type of business loans to get these set up. So does a recession, interest rates rising a lot, does that make capital harder to come by and maybe slows the unit growth in some way on that side?
No, I don't think so. Most of the franchisees are not really using a significant amount of debt for, you know, for opening it. So there might be some small amount of debt, but I don't think that's going to be changing that dramatically with the equipment financing. You know, if they were able to gross, you know, 350 studios during COVID, you know, which was arguably the worst period in history for their business, certainly the worst period in the last 25 years, then, you know, I'm not too worried about whatever recession might be coming for 2022 or 2023, which, you know, we still haven't actually seen a true recession, right? I mean, the economy and the wage, you know, job market's still strong. So I think the stock market is obviously predicting a recession, and that very well could end up being true. But, you know, we haven't actually seen it physically in the economy yet.
I was about to say September, definitely the stock market was definitely predicting a recession in September, but
totally. And the stock market's forward looking. That's the stock market's job. So the stock market's not wrong in doing that necessarily, but it's just the future is uncertain and we'll see where the economy goes.
One thing we should have mentioned earlier, I think, before we talk a recession, the company likes to say, hey, you know, you guys talk bad risks. I obviously was hitting on the curves at Parallels earlier. You guys talk about all this. We've never had a box close in our history. I guess just to you, is that true? Because obviously that speaks to the strength of the model and stuff. Still very young, but that's still pretty crazy.
I was absolutely shocked when they told me that. I mean, I have no reason not to believe it, but it is a shocking statistic. You know, I think they do take, obviously there is turnover. You know, someone unfortunately could die or there could be a reason why there might be turnover in, you know, the ownership of one of the fitness clubs. And so they might take it over temporarily, you know, while they're basically reassigning or reselling that license.
Yeah, but still,
aside from that, that's a very small portion of the base. I think maybe they have like 50 or 49 that are corporate owned right now or corporate run. So it's been very impressive. And I did talk to people that were skeptical of the model. I talked to, you know, a former employee who was, you know, very negative on the company, you know, a little bit critical of the management team. And, you know, everything that she said, I did channel checks on and just didn't pan out to be true. You know,
what were her main pushbacks?
I'm just kind of thinking, I want to be careful. She was arguing that the market potential of, you know, some of the smaller brands was not the same as some of the larger brands, which I think is true, you know, objective. Yeah. You know, I don't think Yoga 6 is ever going to be the same size as, you know, Club Pilates or Pure Barre. I think that's an absolute fact. You know, she was critical, you know, somewhat of the management team, but her main critique, honestly, was just that Tony really likes to make money. I mean, he drives a hard bargain. And honestly, like, I'm okay with that. Like, that's, you know, he sounds like a good businessman to me. So it wasn't critiques that I was necessarily overly concerned about. Nothing. And she basically was saying also that, you know, some of the franchisees were unhappy. But, you know, when I realized that no store had ever, or no club had ever really closed, I mean, that sort of negates that. So I did look into a lot of sort of the bearish points on the name and just found them to be, you know, not consistent with the facts.
It's one of the really tough things with talking to formers. And I've made this point all the time, you know, a lot of the formers, they are formers and some of them are very happy, right? They hit 65, they're ready to retire. The stock's gone up 10 times over the past 20 years. They retire wealthy. Management gives them a watch as they retire, right? But a lot of the formers are management gave them the axe and they have an axe to grind because maybe they had a bitter dispute with management. A lot of times it's, hey, it was me or that guy for the CEO job. He got promoted, so I had to leave. Like there can be a lot of bitterness. So it's one of the tough things with talking to former. And as you said, like to have zero boxes closed, especially through COVID, at this point, we probably would have seen the results if like boxes were closing left or right, or they were just doing desperate Hail Marys to kind of bail out clubs during COVID. And it hasn't seen any of that. So that's interesting. More on recessions, yeah. Right?
And just one other thing on former employees is I think oftentimes they also just lack the perspective of being like they might be a regional manager, or they might, you know, they might manage 30, you know, of the clubs within a network of 2,300. Like they just might lack the perspective of being like the CEO. Like they might just be thinking too small and within the company and not thinking like the larger picture of the business.
I know you and I have connected on Party City before, but like a lot of times I just remember I did one call with Party City, which it was someone who had managed like 4 Party City stores or something. Right. And had this list of complaints and some of them, you know, as an outsider, I would say some of them were valid. And then as an outsider, I would say some of them were like, oh, well, you're running this from the perspective of 4 stores and Party City is running this from this perspective of 500 stores nationwide. And some of the stuff you wanted to do just like wouldn't be doable when you're trying to manage hundreds of stores and a supply chain and everything, right? So I'm with you. It can 100% get...
But that's our job as analysts is to filter out what's good, you know, former employee information versus not. You know, it's investigative journalism style primary research. Like that's what you're trying to figure out is what's true and what's not.
Just on recession risk. So the CEO said, hey, we talked about earlier how the CEO said, look, I did LA boxing and I think UFC gyms in 2008. People were really worried about recession. And I think a lot of these people like they love this so much that they would literally go on welfare before they gave up their boutique gym membership. You know, these people he's mentioned, hey, they make a lot of money. This is a drop in the bucket for them. They've talked about the community. You know, if you go do a lot of CrossFit, you'll build community there. Rumble hosts single night. So you're going to Rumble, not just for the exercise, but to meet other people and stuff, right? So they've got all that going for them on recession. But I do wonder, like a recession in 2008 versus today, like today people have been trained. If you can't go to the gym in person, you know, we can all remember COVID, working out at your home and stuff. There are options today that there weren't back in kind of 2008, right? Like you could, a lot of people bought Pelotons. A lot of people have Peloton memberships. You can get boutique style classes for a lot cheaper with a Peloton app or any of the other apps that you can do. You know, that would be, if you just did the Peloton app, that's $40 a month versus the in-person 200 or whatever it is per month, 150, 200. A lot of gyms have started offering boutique classes. I don't remember lots of them in 2008. So you could maybe join a lower cost gym and get boutique classes. Not quite as good, but you know, there's a lot of substitution that I don't think we're was around in kind of the 2008 era. So again, I threw a lot at you. I'll just pause there to let you talk about recession risk.
Yeah, I think the substitution, I think is tough, right? Like I think it's very difficult to find like high quality, group fitness classes outside of something like Equinox, where, you know, Equinox is more expensive than
Equinox is more exponential business. As expensive as a Rumble membership. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's tough to find like the quality that they provide at a similar price point. You know, I think you're going to go down in quality a lot. And I think we definitely saw during the pandemic. I mean, I certainly didn't like working out at home. I mean, I think people worked out less. Obviously, people got in worse shape. I mean, people gained a lot of weight during the pandemic, right? And that was because we didn't have access to gyms. I mean, gyms are good for public health. And I think that's really important. And I think people also really got a sense for how much they appreciated gyms during the pandemic, because once they were taken away, you know, people really wanted to go back to the gym. So I think certainly from my perspective, like I hated not being able to go to the gym. And so, you know, that would be a huge priority for me. You know, if there was a big recession and I had to cut expenses, like a gym membership would certainly not be something I would cut. And I'm sure there's some percentage of people that would cut gym memberships. I'm not saying it's zero, but I don't think it's the vast majority of people. I think the vast majority of people are really happy to be back in the gyms and don't anticipate that changing.
You know, I'm definitely with you there. My only worry on that side is, you know, I think of my own personal experience. At the height of COVID, I was Pelotoning all the time. And I was like, I love Peloton. I'm going to do this 6 times a week for the rest of my life. And then once gyms reopened, I started going. My CEO always loves to tease me. As soon as the gyms reopened, my Peloton went to like once a week as an alternative workout. And I'm at the gym every day. It's right. Like, look, you didn't even know your own behavior during COVID. You couldn't predict your own behavior. Like, how are you supposed to predict other people's behavior going forward? The future is so unknowable. So I agree with your theory there. I just worry that maybe you and I are basing it too much on our own insights, or just human nature is unknowable, you know?
Yeah, they just got back to their pre-COVID AUVs, right? So I think it's not like they vastly, you know, it's not like they had this massive burst, you know, as things reopened where they were like significantly in excess of their pre-COVID AUVs. They actually just got back to pre-COVID AUVs. You know, inflation adjusted, they're still probably below their pre-COVID AUVs. So I don't think there was this pent-up demand where, you know, there was this explosion in their gym use that's going to revert. And I think the other thing that's worth pointing out is that, you know, if the, you know, average person is paying, say, $1,500 a year for their gym memberships and makes, you know, $130,000 a year, like it's just over 1% of their overall expenses. So I just don't expect that it's material enough where they're going to be changing that. They're going to need that extra 1%, you know, because of a recession.
And again, like I talked about how things are different today than the recession 10 or 15 years ago or whatever, but you know what else is different? A lot of people, I could be wrong. I wasn't around, you know, going to boutique gyms in 2008, but I do think gyms have fostered more of a sense of community now, where, you know, 20 years ago, I think you just went to the gym, did your own thing. With these boutique gyms, they generate a big sense of community. Like, I know a ton of the people who go to my gym. If you drop that, yes, you're saving the expense, but you're also losing that community a little bit, right? And paying for community is something that people will kind of, again, they'll stretch their budget to keep. We've talked about a lot of stuff here. I'm cognizant of time. I want to ask two last questions, and then we can probably wrap this up unless there's anything else you want to talk about.
If I can just jump in on one thing just related to the recession, I think a lot of the fitness concepts that have, you know, gone bankrupt or had trouble were over-levered, and they were, you know, they were smaller gym businesses that were over-levered going into recession, right? So like, you know, Town Sports, which owned New York Sports Club, you know, that was like a few New York gyms and they were way too levered. You know, XBOF is a franchisee, you know, like they're the franchisor, you know, they have some leverage, but it's a very appropriate amount of leverage. So I just think this is a different concept than other gym concepts that have really had trouble or struggled over time.
I just laugh every time at New York Sports Club because they went bankrupt before COVID. And I actually think that would have been a really successful equity play. I got burned on a little bit because then COVID came and destroyed them. But I've never seen a company, they proved the value of subscriptions, because I've never seen a company so difficult to cancel a membership from before. I don't know if you would literally, like, signing up was easy, but if you wanted to cancel, you like had to send a certified letter to some office and if it didn't hit on the certain day or certain time, it was the worst. All right, two last questions. First, I always ask about share buybacks. This is a hyper growth story. They're just kind of hitting the EBITDA and cash flow inflection point. Obviously, they generate cash, but it's going to be a lot more as the growth comes in and kind of they do. So I don't think we need to talk share buybacks, but that does raise another question, right? Like, management obviously sees the value here. They are huge believers in the story. It's firing on all cylinders. You know, you've got this quote from a conference in September. This last quarter was the best quarter the company has ever had in every KPI, in every metric, right? So they see the value. It's firing on all cylinders. Yes, they're significant shareholders, but why aren't they buying shares on the open market?
I think they're more focused on being acquisitive at this point. So, you know, their main interest, I think, is building cash so they can be acquisitive at this point in time. But I think we'll definitely see stock buybacks in the future. And I agree with you. I would love to see them buying back stock. So I wouldn't take the other side of that. I think buying back stock would be a great use of capital for them.
It would be the rare franchise model if at some point they didn't return capital shareholders, right? Because that's the beauty of a franchise model. All this cash flow comes in and eventually you have no choice kind of but to return it to your shareholders, or else you'll just become a cash bank, basically.
Yeah.
Last question here. Look, I've thrown a lot of risk at you. I threw recession risk. I threw the curves history and the history of bad and all this other stuff here. But, you know, I guess you address them all. But just to wrap it up, like, what do you think kills the story, or where do you think you could be wrong? And, you know, if 3 years from now you and I are talking and we're pitching a new name, we say, oh, XBOF didn't do well. Like, what's the big thing that keeps you up at night here?
I don't think there's anything specific, but I think you hit on all the right points, right? I think it's the sustainability of the brands at the end of the day. So I think, you know, we have to be tracking those brands and making sure that they continue to be successful and make sure that the KPIs, you know, continue to head in the right direction. I think the probability of that is extremely high, but that's definitely something we need to be monitoring is there are certainly brands, you know, that fail ultimately. And so we just have to be making sure that their portfolio brands continues to do really well.
I guess the other thing that could kill it is if they did kind of like transformative M&A. You know, there's bolt-on M&A where you go acquire a business for 10 or 20 million, and then there's transformative M&A, which is generally a bet the company or a bet the equity type story.
Sure.
Obviously, these guys are going to be acquisitive, but their acquisitions historically have been more along the Club Pilates line, right? Like buy something with 12 boxes and then grow it to 750. There are things they could do that are transformative. You know, they could go buy CrossFit or something, but it seems to me the acquisition story is going to be more bolt-ons continued along that Club Pilates model. So is there a risk they burn $10 million on a bad acquisition? Yes, but I don't think we're talking like company-altering risk. Please feel free to tell me if I'm misinterpreting that.
No, I totally agree with you. No, and they've stated that as their clear intention too. They're not going to go out and do anything huge. You know, the chairman is very successful former private equity. So there's not... there's smart financial thinking minds on the board. They're very careful. And so, yeah, we don't expect them to bet the farm on anything.
Cool. Hey, we've talked about a ton of stuff here, but just want to turn it over to you. Anything we didn't discuss that you think we should be thinking about, or anything we kind of glanced over that you think we should be thinking about harder?
No, I think you did a really good job of, you know, an overview of the business. I think people should really just focus on, like, it's highly predictable. It takes some time to get an understanding of the business. Like, it definitely is worth the time though, because once I studied it, I was very confident in just its ability to do extremely well in pretty much any environment. And I think from a risk adjusted perspective, like, you're getting an extremely high IRR. You know, there might be IRRs that could be potentially higher in this environment, but I think, you know, this is a pretty low risk investment. The probability of this outcome, I think, you know, a positive outcome is quite high.
Look, I think I said it up front, but when you said you wanted, we talked about a bunch of names, and when you said you want to do XBOF, I was like, oh, a fitness. Like, I initially had that thought that the sell side led off with, which, oh, the history of fitness companies in the public markets is really poor. And I thought I was going to get you with my curve thing. But when I was researching this last night, I was surprised by how bullish I was and how much I was like, oh, I can see what Zach really sees in the story. And, you know, one day of research isn't enough for me, but it's a name. I love fitness. It's a name I'm going to be diving a lot deeper on, because I'm with you. 20 times EBITDA for, as they said, if we never signed another deal, like, we've got so many boxes coming online, like, we've got so much growth in store. 20 becomes 10 real fast, and 10 times is not the right multiple for a franchisor.
Yep. Yeah, I totally agree.
Cool. Well, hey, this has been great. Zach Buckley, I'll include a link to your Twitter in the show notes. So if anybody wants to go find you on Twitter and kind of let you know their great experiences or how Rumble had a bad class and the instructor was 15 minutes late one time, they can slide on over to your DMs. But Zach, thanks so much for coming on, and looking forward to having you again.
All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
A quick disclaimer, nothing on this podcast should be considered investment advice. Guests or the hosts may have positions in any of the stocks mentioned during this podcast. Please do your own work and consult a financial advisor. Thanks.